This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Molly Cox Bryan lives in Waynesboro, and her cheerful paperbound mysteries are not just in regular bookstores, but in every author's dream locations, Walmart and Target. Molly describes her Cumberland Creek mystery series as cozies with an edge. You said you like to describe your mysteries as cozies with an edge. And I said, stop, wait till we turn the mics on. So go with that.
Well, cozy mysteries are always involving amateur sleuths. And there's no graphic sex, no graphic violence. That's all sort of happens off camera, if you will. My books don't have graphic sex or violence in them, but the women in my books certainly do talk about those things. And it's a, you know, it's a part of their lives. So, and I think there's a sort of a suspense element to some of my mysteries that a lot of cozy mysteries don't have. They're more focused on the puzzle quality to the mystery. So that's the difference.
I met the talented Molly Cox Bryan a few years ago to talk about pie, as in Mrs. Rowe's Little Book of Southern Pies. Yes, it is that Mrs. Rouse of the legendary Stanton restaurant. Molly, who'd been a journalist her whole professional life, is also the author of Mrs. Rouse Restaurant Cookbook. So what, I asked, led her from cookbooks to her Cumberland Creek mystery series that dances around, to me, the unlikely maypole of scrapbooking?
Well, I've always been a storyteller. And if 20 years ago somebody told me I would be writing cookbooks, I would have told them, there's just no way, you know. What appealed to me about those books were, what it was Mrs. Rouse's story. And there's a lot of stories there. So how I got from there was, I'd always been writing little stories and poems and things like that. And I had this story in the back of my head of these women getting together to scrapbook. And I talked to my agent about it, and one National Novel Writing Month, which comes up every November, I decided, what the heck, you know, let me try.
Explain National Novel Writing Month.
That's where a group of writers nationally get together, and that now it's huge. I mean, there are local groups all over the country, and I think maybe even internationally now. I'm not sure about that. Where we make a commitment to write a 50,000-word novel within the month of November. And so I tried it, and it went well.
Did that turn into your first novel?
Yeah.
And how close did you come in 30 days of writing to what became Scrapbook of Secrets?
Well, I'd say it was a pretty good first draft. And I think that's one of the things I learned during that month, and it's been a very valuable skill from that point on, whereas, you know, sort of just getting those words down for your first draft, not being married to those words and knowing that you can go back, you know, and really committing to that, you know, that is a very valuable lesson.
So you're saying sort of write through it, mm-hmm. and then go back and tweak it?
Yes.
Okay.
Again and again and again. I think it was probably five or six drafts until I submitted it to my agent, and she had, of course, several comments and wanted to see some changes. And then, of course, when it goes through the editorial process, the editors always have stuff to say. So, and you really need to be open to it.
All right, you say you've always written. Tell me about you, Molly, as a professional word person, please.
I have a degree in journalism and communications. And I worked in nonprofits outside of the D.C. area in editorial positions, newsletters, magazines, and things like that. I wrote about math education. I wrote about construction and airline tariffs, and really learned a lot from working with some of the editors.
Such as?
Well, I had one editor at the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics who was such a language, everything from the difference between which and that, and when to use the commas and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, that it helps. You know, I really hate to see the trend in a lot of schools today not teaching grammar, but, you know, because I think it really helps to communicate. And so that kind of thing, I don't think I got even in college. You know, I didn't get that until I worked every day with those editors.
And then it becomes what you hear in your head when you're writing.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So you're writing about math. Take me through from writing about math to writing about food.
When I moved to the Shenandoah Valley, I kept hearing these stories about Mrs. Rao. And, you know, my journalist's ears sort of started pricking.
Yes, vibrating.
Yeah. And I started to, you know, investigate that. And I approached the restaurant about writing her story. And it was going to be just a you know, a self-published biography of Mrs. Rao. But it sort of led me to this national market. I had no idea that restaurant was so popular. And it really is. People plan their vacations around it. And in doing that book, I discovered the whole world of food writing, because I started to go to conferences and meet other food writers. And writing about food is just wonderful. I mean, it's such a great beat to have, because just think of all the different directions you can go, all the touchstones with different cultures. And I loved writing about food.
Now, you say that Mrs. Rao started out, it was going to be a self-published sort of little, very nice kind of hoo-ha book. And then you got to a national market. How did that happen?
Well, I wrote basically like a 300-page biography. Mm-hmm. I mean, the woman's life was incredible. So I went to the National Symposium for Professional Food Writers, which in those days was held at the Greenbrier. I met my agent, who I loved, and signed on. And in the meantime, Mrs. Rao had passed away. And I was quoted in the local papers as being her biographer. I received notes from all over the country. And so that's how we knew that there was a national market, or how we suspected there was a national market for it, and decided to go ahead and sign up with the agent. And when I say we, I mean the restaurant and I, because we partnered in this. So that's how that happened. It's kind of an incredible story. You know, this woman who grew up in the hills of Virginia that went on to found this restaurant that is one of the most successful family-owned restaurants in the state of Virginia.
And then came Pies.
Yes, which was an outgrowth of that first book. There just absolutely was not enough room in that book for all the pies. You know?
And you can't have too much pie.
No, you can't. And she was famous for her pies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you still writing about food other than Mrs. Rao's food? Or what were you doing? You know, I'm still interested in that segue. Were you scrapbooking? I mean, what was going on?
I was freelancing. Mm-hmm. I did work for, let's see, Christian Science Monitor, and Grit Magazine was one of my steady clients. Taste of the South Magazine. So I did a lot of food writing. So the whole Mrs. Rao thing opened up a lot of opportunities for me. Around the time that I started to work on my fiction more seriously, I was losing editors, you know, with publishing going through such a difficult time, editors just disappearing. And I could see that it was going to get more difficult for me to earn a living with the food writing. I didn't actually give up on it, but it was a certain month when, I think it was October, November, when National Novel Writing was happening, probably 2009, something like that.
So not that long ago.
No. Mm-mm. I thought, well, you know, I only had like two events that month when I was promoting the Mrs. Rao book, and I might have had two deadlines or something that month. And if I'm going to do it, this is the month to do it. So that's sort of how that happened. And in the meantime, my agent had taken on a partner who dealt with fiction. My agent was a culinary. So, you know, they would sort of check in with me that month. And I think that my agent had mentioned to me several times that she thought I could do fiction just from reading some of the other stuff that I'd written.
And what about what you'd written made her think this? Do you suppose? I don't know if she told you.
I think if you look at the first Mrs. Rao book, it's very much a story. It almost in places reads like fiction. And I think that's what she meant.
How did you find the transition from reporting to writing fiction? It's a transition lots of people have, in my experience, have great difficulty with. And you don't seem to have had great difficulty.
It felt very freeing to me. I think this is something I was always meant to do. And it engages sort of both parts. The mystery writing engages that reporting element in me because I you know, you have to check those facts and make sure that they're, you know, that they're spot on or you will get called on it. I really just think that was meant to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How come scrapbooking came into it?
Well, I do like to scrapbook. I don't get to do it as often as I would like.
Do you want to explain what scrapbooking is in case somebody out there, you know, I grew up with photographs pasted haphazardly in a book, and that was our scrapbook. But what you're talking about is a very different thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge hobby, and there are all kinds of, you know, stickers and embellishments and beautiful scrapbooks, and it can get very artsy. It can also be very basic and very simple, and it's a really good way of keeping your memories, you know, mm-hmm. for your family. And I love some of those old scrapbooks. My grandmother, I have some of hers, you know, with the black paper and
yes.
and all that. I think they're wonderful, too. So it's a huge hobby. It really is.
So you were scrapbooking away.
Yes. And, you know, I've always thought that scrapbooking had kind of a puzzle quality to it. And I liked that, and I liked the social aspect to it, that there are people getting together to do it. And I had some experience with that, and I found scrapbookers to be, you know, wonderful, generous people with their stuff and with their food. And
yeah, there's a lot of food in this.
Yeah.
It's really yummy sounding.
Yeah, there's a lot of food. And so one of the challenges I set up for myself in doing these books is to keep the scrapbooking as a central part of the plot. Because a lot of the craft mysteries will be set in a knitting shop or in a scrapbooking shop, and it has really nothing to do with the craft.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted this to have something.
A plot point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cumberland Creek. It's fictitious. Tell me about Cumberland Creek.
Well, it's in the Shenandoah Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like a combination. When I'm writing about it, I think of Waynesboro and Stanton. But it's not either one of those places.
And I think there's a little Lexington somehow
Maybe.
Thrown
mm-hmm.
in. Do you have a map of the town?
I don't, but I've thought about drawing one. I mean, I definitely have sort of a map in my head. I know where the river is, where the mountains are, where the hollows are.
Back after a break with more conversation about mystery writing with Waynesboro's Molly Cox Bryan. Back before the break, we heard how Molly Cox Bryan is in the midst of creating her very successful Cumberland Creek mystery series. Molly calls her books Cozies with an Edge. Her murders are solved by a group of women who live in a small Shenandoah Valley city and get together to scrapbook.
I probably don't remember. I have a lot of moments in the shower, too, and some of those turn out to be something, and other times it just doesn't. But I like the idea of a group of women getting together to do something like that. You know, they're all bringing their own things to the table, and they all have their own stories and their family stories, and I like that.
Now, why a group of women for you?
Well, you know, I like women's stories. That's what I'm compelled to tell, whether it's through cookbooks, or fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really say why that is, or I'm really not sure why that is. It's just who I am. Yeah.
Yeah. These women are people with full lives, and they're just women who get together to scrapbook.
And solve murders.
And solve murders. There's a constellation of characters you project it's going to stay through all the books?
For three books, for the trilogy of the books, yes. The third book is already with the publisher. I've been made an offer to do two more books, and I'm not sure if they will focus on the same three women or if I may veer off into some of the secondary characters, but there will always be the same group of women.
So you wrote your first scrapbook mystery in 30 days. Your culinary agent got a fiction partner. You're off to the races. At what point did you decide this is a trilogy, or was that a decision your agent made?
Well, she said to me when we pitched it, she said, if you have an idea for a second book, we need to pitch that along with the first book because series sell much easier. And so I did. Coming up with ideas is not a problem.
Not a problem. You just yeah. got in the shower and there it was.
There was. Yeah. So, and then when the contract came back, it was for a three-book deal. And so that's how that happened.
Did you feel any pressure or did you just go, yippee?
I wouldn't say that I felt pressure, but I went back to that challenge that I gave myself, which was, how am I going to keep the scrapbooking as a part of the plot?
Mm-hmm.
The first book, these women are putting together scrapbooks. They're putting together this woman's life through scrapbooks, finding out her secrets. In the second book, which is Scrapped, my women are getting together and they're tearing apart a very mysterious scrapbook to learn more about a new person in town. So my thought was, what am I going to do for that third book?
You've put together, you've torn apart. Now what?
Yeah. In the third book, there's two mysteries. There's one, the murder mystery, and the other mystery is a mystery concerning a book that somebody finds, a scrapbook that somebody finds, and they sort of link.
That sounds very complicated. So let's get to how you work these things out. You say you do a draft. Do you know at the beginning of that first draft where you're going?
No.
Not a clue. Okay.
Not a clue. I wish I did.
And you can do a mystery. Do you know what the mystery is going to be when you start?
I usually start with the image of the murder and what happened here.
Okay.
And that's what sort of propels me forward. And then also the murder, I think of it as being one layer of the book. And then the other things that propel me forward are, okay, what's going on in like Beatrice's life right now and that kind of thing. So, and I think in the first book, especially, that may be why people are so surprised by the ending is because I was surprised. You know,
very
I'm not
nice.
Sure that I could work as a plotter. I mean, I know mystery writers that do that. They outline everything and they plot everything. They just really sort of have to fill it in when they're writing. But to me, I like that organic process.
You want to discover the story as you go along. Three main characters. Why don't you describe those three main scrapbookers?
Okay. Well, Annie Shamovitz is new to town. She's the only Jewish woman in town. And she used to work as an investigative reporter. Now she's a stay-at-home mom to two boys. And
rambunctious boys.
Yes, yeah. It's been a year since she's been in Cumberland Creek, and she hasn't made any friends. And that became an interesting issue with my editor because I had that it had been 3 years. Having lived in a small southern town, that's very possible, I think. But he said, no, it doesn't sound realistic to me. So that was changed. And then she meets Vera in the library one afternoon, and they hit it off. And Vera is a native. She went away for a while to study dance. She now lives back in Cumberland Creek and owns a dance studio. She's a very savvy businesswoman, although sometimes you might think she's much more interested in her hair and her nails and things like that.
She's a very complicated person. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And very open heart. When I think of Vera, I think of that open heart of hers. Then we have Beatrice, who is Vera's mother, who is 80 years old at the beginning of this book. She was a quantum physicist. And she...
Which was it? I went, okay. This is not a dotty old lady we have here.
No, and she's in great shape. She loves to cook. And she's not sure what she thinks of the scrapbooker. She doesn't scrapbook. Mm-hmm. And
which I think is nice that you have somebody, a main character, who's a little bit of a skeptic or an outsider.
Mm-hmm. She's a very bright lady, and she's very she says it like it is, and I love Beatrice.
It's fun to create a character that you really like, isn't mm-hmm. it? And you get to spend time with.
Mm-hmm.
What's an interview with a published author without a bit from her book? But duh, Molly and I got to talking, and I just forgot to ask her to read something. So our development director, Diane Hawke, graciously agreed to step in. Molly chose a short section from her first book, Scrapbook of Secrets, for Diane to read. She likes this section, Molly says, because it touches on some of the deeper issues in her books. In it, 80-year-old Beatrice is just about to go into surgery. And Vera, her 41-year-old daughter, who once very much wanted to be a ballerina until life intervened, is with her.
Her mother's face suddenly softened, the lines almost fading. "I'm an old fool," she said. "And where is your father?" "I cried about the beauty shop. It's closing. Things have a way of changing before you know it. I do love you, Vera, even if you're getting fat." "Ha, my fat little ballerina," she said, and seemed to fall asleep. Vera laughed. "I love you too, Mama." Vera had made up her mind to stop dieting last year. She decided to become a better role model for her students, and there was just no point in starving herself any longer. She would never be a ballerina. She had been on a diet for more than 30 years, after her dance teacher made a remark about her thighs when Vera was 10 years old. "Forget her. I am not starving anymore." It was so freeing. The first thing she ate, really ate with abandon, was her mother's blackberry cobbler. Not a piece of cobbler, but the whole thing. She sat at her mother's 1950s chrome and turquoise Formica kitchen table set, the same table from which she had eaten almost every meal when she was a girl, and ate a piece while it was still fresh out of the oven. "Do you have any vanilla ice cream, Mom?" "Ha, sure," answered Beatrice, who was visibly taken aback by her daughter's sudden love of blackberry cobbler. "I have always loved it, Ma," Vera said, as if reading her mind. "I just was always watching my weight, and I figure, well, what's the point?" Vera then ate a slice covered with vanilla ice cream, real ice cream, for her mother never bought anything low-fat or low-carb or low-sugar. She almost fainted at the creaminess, the mixture of textures and temperatures in her mouth. The next piece was covered with a dollop of whipped cream, while her mother tried to look busy wiping off a non-existent crumb from the teal-speckled Formica counter, not wanting to stare at her only child as she seemed to be enjoying a private moment with the cobbler. As Vera relished each bite, the mixture of the gritty and gelatinous mingled with sweet, juicy berries covered with a light but substantial crust, her mother gave up her stance and watched intently. Her mouth hung open after Vera's fourth piece. She handed her the pan. "Here, baby, this is the best way. Have at it," she said, and left Vera alone with the blackberry cobbler. Later, she explained that she felt it was the only proper thing to do. After all, Vera had not touched cobbler, pie, or cake since she was 10 years old. So Vera had put on about 20 pounds. But it was a good gain. She had more breasts and hips and thighs than ever before. And she loved her body. It was hers, and it did everything it was supposed to do, and more. She rewarded it often with good chocolate, preferably fresh and artisanal. She was still a graceful woman and dancer, even with the extra 20 pounds, and she was a happier person.
So the trilogy is done, and there are two more that are about scrapbooking or centered around scrapbooking.
Well, they're going to be a part of the Cumberland Creek Mystery Series, and there will always be some form of scrapbooking, and there will always be these same characters.
Okay.
There's so much in this little town, which is fictitious.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many like side characters there that it would be fun to explore. I'm really just not sure where it's going to go. I was just made the offer in December. I was done. I mean, I thought that was it when I wrote that third book.
On to whatever's next?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they came back for you.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that lovely?
I tell you, I'm still pinching myself because I've always had to pitch everything. Pitch and pitch and pitch. And to want, for once, you know, I not have to pitch.
To be pitched.
Yes.
When people ask you what you do for a living, what do you say?
You know, I tell them I'm a writer. A lot of times people just ignore that. Other times, you know, people say, well, what do you write? So that's nice, you know, when people are interested like that. And they'll say, well, you know, I write mysteries and cookbooks. You mentioned pie, everybody kind of smiles.
You'll find a link to Molly Cox Bryan's website, Facebook page, and Twitter feed on the Spark page at WMRA.org. Mm-hmm.